Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere, like at your pregame barbecue. While you prep your meats, that grease trap you forgot to empty is prepping to smoke your porch, garage, and the car inside. And without the right home and auto insurance coverage, the cost to repair this could eat up your savings. So bundle home and auto with Allstate to save and get protected from mayhem like this. Bundled savings vary and are not available in every state. Coverage is subject to policy terms and conditions.
We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It's an insider's look at the NBA and the culture surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on the hottest topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yeah, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
The Volume.
The thrill and excitement of March Mania is here, and DraftKings Sportsbook, one of America's top-rated sportsbook apps, is giving new customers a shot to turn $5 into $150 instantly in bonus bets with any college basketball bet. You could bet on absolutely anything. If you want to bet on UConn or North Carolina, fans can get in on this year to bet them to win the title, all the way down to teams like Stetson and Longwood to win the title. You can even bet individual seeds to win the title. You can bet anything on DraftKings for the tournament. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code HOOPS. New customers can bet $5 to get $150 instantly in bonus bets only at DraftKings Sportsbook with code HOOPS. That's H-O-O-P-S. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER, or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY to 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly on behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas. 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.com/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources. All right, welcome to Hoops Tonight here at The Volume. Happy Monday, everybody. Hope all of you guys had an incredible weekend. We have a jam-packed show for you today. We're going to start with that absurdly entertaining matchup between the Dallas Mavericks and the Denver Nuggets last night, ended by a legendary Kyrie Irving shot. We're going to break that game down from the perspective of both teams. After that, the Phoenix Suns went on the road into Milwaukee and got their ass kicked. A nuclear shooting performance from them wasn't enough for the even more nuclear performance they gave up from Milwaukee, so we're going to break that game down. After that, there was a lot of talk going on yesterday after Kyrie's left-handed hook shot to win the game, but also after Damian Lillard said that he's the most skilled player ever, about whether or not Kyrie Irving is the most skilled player ever. And so I have a take on that front, kind of diving into what I interpret to mean basketball skill, where I do think Kyrie has an edge, who I would name if I had to pick a most skilled. We'll do that as our third segment. And like we do every single Monday at the end of the show, we'll have our latest edition of the Power Rankings. You guys know the drill. Before we get started, subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel. It means a lot to me. If you guys take a second to scroll down, hit that subscribe button. Don't forget about my podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts, under Hoops Tonight. It's also super helpful if you leave a rating and a review on that front. Don't forget about my Twitter feed, _JasonLT, where I leave film threads as well as show announcements. I did a film thread this morning on like five or six examples of some of the really, really poor defense that Phoenix was playing against Milwaukee. You can find that on my Twitter feed. And last but not least, keep dropping mailbag questions in the YouTube comments so we can keep hitting them throughout the rest of this week. We'll have a mailbag in tomorrow's show. And then before we get started, this is the best time of year to go out and see a basketball game. Obviously, we've got the NBA season heating up going into the playoffs, and obviously playoff basketball is highly entertaining. But we also have college basketball in the tournament. Single elimination basketball, especially when we get to this phase, is the most entertaining basketball that you'll see in person. And specifically, when you go to these arenas for these NCAA tournament games, it's kind of, if you've ever been to one, I've been to two myself, and I'm sure some of you guys have as well. When you're in those arenas, the crazy back and forth vibe of the two fan bases kind of competing with each other on every big play, it really is a unique experience for a basketball fan. I want you guys to get out to an arena and check out one of those games. And this is where I want to tell you guys about Game Time. Game Time is an amazing ticketing app for you guys to check out. They have a super easy process. You can buy a ticket in just two taps. You never have to worry about convoluted pricing. They have all-in pricing, so you can see exactly what you're going to pay before you put the ticket in your cart. And you know exactly what you're getting yourself into when you show up at the arena. No showing up to a seat that has obstructed view, or the view isn't as good as you were hoping when you bought the ticket. You get a really good representation of what your seat's going to look like before you check out. I highly recommend you guys try Game Time. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use code HOOPS for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code HOOPS. That's H-O-O-P-S for $20 off. Download Game Time today. Last minute tickets, lowest price guaranteed. All right, let's talk some basketball. So Nuggets Mavs, I want to start with the end of the game, and then we'll get to some of the stuff later on, because it really was a super entertaining finish. It basically came down to matchup hunting late. The same kind of stuff we're always accustomed to seeing from Denver, right? The Jokic-Murray two-man game. They were specifically targeting Luka Doncic in every action that they could on that end of the floor. And then on the other end of the floor, Kyrie and Luka were constantly trying to pick on Jamal Murray. And we're going to dive into this a little bit later when we get into some of the stuff with Denver. But I did not think Denver did a good job trying to avoid those switches. I thought they conceded those switches. And honestly, they got away with it because the Mavericks were up by nine with about 4 minutes left. And they turned that, Denver turned that 9-point deficit into a tie game at 102 in about 3 minutes. And a big part of that was there were some possessions where Luka and Kyrie got Jamal Murray onto switches, got really good looks for them, and missed both of them. The one I'm thinking of is the floater that Kyrie had in the middle of the floor. And then Luka had like a turnaround jump shot, kind of one like fade away around the foul line. That one went in and out as well. And so like a lot of it was just kind of good fortune, but I thought Denver could have done a better job of trying to prevent those switches from happening, because it just, you know, they have the ability with Aaron Gordon to keep a big body on Luka and to make it tougher on him. They have the ability with a guard defender like KCP to make him take tough shots over an excellent defender. And so we'll get a little bit deeper into that when we get to the Denver side of things. But it was a lot of matchup hunting. And then on the Dallas side, they were attacking Jamal Murray. And on the Denver side, they were attacking Luka Doncic. And in that stretch, they were just getting better stuff. On the other end, Denver scored on almost every single possession during that stretch, just either getting, you know, Luka switched on to Jokic and Jokic just taking him down in the post and getting an easy basket, or like Jamal Murray in a two-man game getting Maxi Kleba. You know, we have all this talk about Kyrie's finish, which obviously was incredible and we're going to get to, but Jamal Murray had a pretty nasty left-handed finish himself where he got Maxi Kleba on his right shoulder, kind of worked him down the lane. Daniel Gafford came over and he just went way out to the side and scooped in a nasty left-handed finish off the glass. And then the final one, when it was 102-102, so it was 102-102. Luka gets the switch on Murray, misses that little turnaround jump shot. But down on the other end at 102-102, Murray gets Luka on a switch and he makes a really smart play. So Kleba's back on Jokic at this point. Jamal kind of drags Luka out to the left side and Jokic comes up to set another ball screen. And Jamal Murray identifies something where he knew he was going to be able to get a clean look. Luka, when he saw the screen coming from Jokic, Luka backed off and then prepared to go underneath Jokic so that he could switch but stay in position on Jokic to not give up an easy, you know, over-the-top pass where he could just rumble into the paint without anybody in front of him, right? So Luka's preparing to duck underneath Jokic to switch, and Kleba's getting ready to jump out on the other side. But again, there's a gap there between where Jamal Murray is and where Kleba's going to be coming on the other side of the screen. And and Luka's ducking under, there's a little opening in there. And Jamal Murray really smartly just throws a little bit of a fake with the dribble to get Luka to commit to the switch. And then he pulled back into that opening, got a really good look at three, knocked it down as 105-102. We go down to the other end, and Aaron Gordon makes a huge mistake, in my opinion. Luka Doncic comes off of a pin down. He's starting kind of at the right elbow. He comes down, and Tim Hardaway Jr. is setting a screen kind of around the top of the key. Luka's not trying to come off for a shot. Luka's just coming off to try to get the basketball because there's like, I think there's like 26 seconds left or something like that. So Luka pops out, catches the ball at like 30 feet. But Aaron Gordon, again, like imagine the top of the key, there's Tim Hardaway Jr., there's Luka coming out 30 feet from the rim. Gordon's down here as he's going to trail Luka. But instead of just running out to meet Luka, he tried to duck under Tim Hardaway on the opposite side of the screen. And so as a result, he was taking a weird kind of banana route to get to where Luka was when that screen wasn't really in position to stop him. He could have just sprinted out. And again, Luka wasn't looking to shoot there, but Luka caught and he was so wide open because Aaron Gordon tried to go around the other side of the screen. He just had all day and he's like, all right, fine, I'm going to shoot this. And it was catastrophic for two reasons. Not only was it the 3-point shot that tied the game, but they didn't take any time off the clock. Like if that exact same thing, like if Aaron Gordon takes a better angle instead of trying to jump the screen, but just trails behind Luka the way you're supposed to, he catches, he turns, probably calls for a screen. By the time he actually gets a quality 3-point shot up, it could be another 5 to 10 seconds. And if it takes 5 to 10 seconds and they make the shot, then it's 105-105, but the shot clock is turned off. And then you could take your time to get a great one. And instead, there was just a little bit of a gap, which put Denver in the predicament because Dallas had a timeout. It put Denver in that predicament where they kind of had to leave some time on the clock. So at that point, you just want to get the best possible shot. Jamal Murray got a great look. They had another Jokic ball screen. PJ Washington actually was switching out on Jamal Murray in his backwards kind of like recovery step. He tripped and fell. And so Jamal got great lift, great separation. One of the easiest shots he got all night there around the right elbow, and he just missed it. But again, because of the bad angle Aaron Gordon took on the other end of the floor, they were in a position where they had to shoot before the end of the shot clock. So then we go down to the other end, just a couple seconds left. Kyrie Irving comes off of that ball or off of that off-ball action, and Jokic switches, and Jokic defends it as perfectly as you possibly can. Even given the insane shot that Kyrie took, it was a very, very good contest from Nikola Jokic, but Kyrie Irving just goes into that rip through to his left and gets to that left-handed floater or half hook or whatever the heck you want to call it and knocks it down. Crowd goes crazy. Really one of the most impressive game winners that I've seen because that was not luck. That is something that Kyrie Irving is capable of doing. There are two things that I want to hit about Kyrie's lefty runner that were so interesting to me. First of all, improvisational shot making. When I talk about scoring the basketball, and I, you know, there's all these different roles that a player has on a basketball team. But to me, one of the specific traits that identifies a player as a scorer is it's kind of like a natural knack for finding ways to put the ball in the basket. To me, that comes down to a combination of obviously the skill set, but there's two additional elements to it. It's audacity and improvisation. Audacity is confidence. Audacity is like, you bet your ass I can take and make this left-handed floater. You bet, like Jamal Murray, for instance, like he's playing on a basketball team with the best player in the world. And that dude has the audacity to look him off and take his own shot sometimes. And it's the right decision because of his abilities as a shot maker. Again, that first piece is the most important part. You have to have the skill set. But from there, if you have the audacity, the confidence, and you connect it with the improvisation, which to me is the natural ability of a scorer to just find kind of funky combinations of skill. So for instance, you might see that left-handed runner and you might think to yourself, Kyrie probably doesn't practice that. And you're right. Like, I doubt sincerely that Kyrie has a drill where he takes a 15-foot drifting one-leg floater moving to his left-hand side off of that specific footwork. He probably doesn't. But what he does do is all the individual pieces of that put together. I've talked about this with a step back three before. A step back three looks like a complicated dribble combination and footwork combination into a shot, but it's really not. Like if I do an in and out dribble and then a between the legs dribble and then an advanced dribble, but instead of continuing that step, I plant that right foot and push back. I stick my left foot way out to catch my momentum so that I go straight up and down. And at the end of the shot, I'm just going straight up and down. So as long as I have the handle to be able to do an in and out between the legs dribble and then another in and out on the other side, I'm good. As long as I have the footwork to be able to make all those plants and control my body weight in those angles, and as long as I have good catch and shoot straight up and down jump shooting ability, I can put all of that together and make this advanced play. Now, again, does Kyrie practice a drifting left-handed floater? Probably not. But what he does practice is a huge variety of left-handed shots around the rim, left-handed floaters and scoops and high finishes, low finishes, you know, trying to sneak by defenders, trying to finish over the top of defenders. He does a ton of stuff with his left hand. That move is a combination of things that Kyrie does work on. The footwork to get that little bit of separation, right? The handle to get the ball into his left hand in a position where he has command of it. And then from there, the touch takes over. But that to me is what improvisational shot making is. And all the best improvisational scorers in the league, they do take shots in games that don't necessarily resemble shots that they take in practice, but it's pieces, little bits and pieces of things that they do practice that they in the moment go, wait, I see this opening, and this is all happening in a fraction of a second. I see this opening. I think I can get to that spot. And then from there, I think I can kind of, you know, maybe just go into like a left-handed kind of half hook, kind of like I do closer to the rim, but I'll just have to put a little more juice on it, you know, that kind of thing. It's like an instantaneous interpretation of the situation. And then the ability to quickly pick from your skill set to grab these little things that you can piece together into a move to make a shot in that specific situation. And to me, that's what separates the best scorers in the world from the guys beneath them. It's they have the skill set, but they also have this overwhelming confidence or audacity, as I call it, and then the improvisation, the ability to think quickly on their feet, to find ways to get to a shot they can make, right? And so that to me is what kind of sets that apart. It's the improvisation, and then the second thing, the fundamental foundation. That was a crazy shot, but make no mistake, it was about his baseline foundation of ball handling, his baseline foundation of footwork, and his baseline foundation of touch. That is fundamental basketball that has been pieced together into basically an art form, right? But like, don't make the mistake of thinking that that doesn't come from a fundamental foundation, because it absolutely does. Now, moving to the rest of the game, I thought the story of the game for Dallas was dominating the bench groups. For Denver specifically on the offensive glass. And Denver's a weird team. Like when you look in the big picture, they're 16th in defensive rebounding percentage. They're bottom half defensive rebounding team, but they're excellent at rebounding with their starters. Even last night, the starting lineup, so Jokic with Gordon, Michael Porter Jr., Jamal Murray, and KCP, those guys grabbed almost 75% of available defensive rebounds, which is excellent. So that wasn't the issue. But those bench groups, what they do, again, like instead of going with a slower, you know, limited center like DeAndre Jordan, they just go with Zeke Nnaji. They do a ton of switching, and they just give the ball to Jamal Murray and just basically let him go to work. And again, like, they're in a predicament. Denver's been in this predicament for a long time where they really struggled to kind of maintain leads without Jokic. That's been a thing forever. That was a thing last year when they won the title. This is just their best pathway to try to float the ship without Nikola Jokic, is to go small, do a lot of switching, and rely on Jamal Murray to make shots. And he just didn't quite have the same shot-making game that he's capable of having. And they got absolutely demolished on the glass in those units, particularly Derek Jones Jr. and Derek Lively were doing a ton of damage. Dallas had 22 offensive rebounds in this game, leading to 23 second-chance points. And as a result, even though they were plus 10, Denver was plus 10 in Nikola Jokic's minutes, Dallas was able to get out of there with the win by dominating those specific lineups. Now, one of the things that I did think was interesting, I don't think it's a complete coincidence that Phoenix and Dallas were the two teams that got wins against Denver since the All-Star break. Because this, again, for people who are not aware, Denver has won every other game they've played since the All-Star break. They're 11-2, I think, in the 13 games since then. And their two losses were Phoenix and Dallas, both games where they led by 3 points with just a few seconds left, and then crazy shot making at the end of the game took the game away from them, right? So like, one of the things that I think is interesting is Dallas and Phoenix both, they're uniquely capable of picking on matchups and actually getting some of Denver's more limited on-ball defenders into space, right? So like, for instance, they're really diligent about getting the switches they want. They make sure that they get the right matchup before they get into their one-on-one play. Now, again, we've talked about it a little bit on the Denver side, and we'll get a little further into it, but I think Denver needs to do a better job of trying to fight against those switches just by, you know, we'll get into that in a minute. But, like, Dallas was very good about diligently getting the right matchups before they go. In addition to that, they are a team that has some speed advantages, right? Like, I'll give you an example. There was a random play mid-fourth quarter where Derrick Jones Jr. was on the right wing, and he had Michael Porter Jr. on him, and he just got him with a basic rip-through move to the left and got all the way to the rim for a layup. And then, like, so when you look at it, and it's like they're getting a lot of shots where it's like, okay, they're getting Michael Porter Jr. on a switch and then going to work. They're getting Jamal Murray on a switch, and they're going to work. So they can be very diligent about getting the right types of shots against the right matchups. And I think that's something that Dallas and Phoenix in particular are really good at. Now, both of those matchups, Denver had extended stretches where they kicked their ass because they're so much bigger and they do have better personnel that they can kind of go to on both ends of the floor to kind of get these jobs done. So, like, I would pick Denver in a series against both of them. But I do think it's interesting and something to keep an eye on in terms of, like, a threat to beat Denver, that both Dallas and Phoenix are these, like, kind of high-level matchup attacking teams that rely a lot on heliocentric kind of a ball screen attack and that can really kind of get Denver's limited defenders in space. On the Denver side of things, getting bullied on the glass in the Jokic off groups is totally normal. Like I mentioned, like Jokic on groups this season have almost a 75% defensive rebound percentage, and they had almost a 75% defensive rebound percentage yesterday. So this is kind of just an issue with their bench. And again, they won last year under the same circumstances. It's never been about, like, oh man, you know, Denver can't overcome its bench. It's like they do overcome their bench. It's like they have a bad bench and then they win anyway. That's pretty much been the story for Denver forever, right? That said, they need to hold up better on the glass than they did. And I did think a lot of it was just not being as quick to the ball. And that's something I think they have a room for improvement on. And then again, like this game and the Suns game, they executed perfectly down the stretch in both games. So, like, if you remember in the Suns game, there was a 12-0 run that turned a 99-90 lead into a 102-99 lead for Denver. And then in this game, it was 109-100, I think. And then they went on a 15-3 run to go up 115-112. So very similarly in both games, Denver went on like a dominant run down the stretch, but they played better defense on the KD shot. Like that one was like Aaron Gordon defended pretty damn well and KD just made the shot. I thought that they had a couple of execution lapses on the defensive end at the end of this game, not just the Aaron Gordon one where he went on the wrong side of that pick, but they were just way too willing to give the right matchups, better matchups to Dallas down the stretch offensively. And the last thing before we move on to the next game, there's a reason why I'm not a big believer in just conceding those switches so easy. First of all, especially when you're like Denver has the ability to put teams in a predicament where if you don't switch or you hedge and recover or you help or you do anything that leaves a shooter open, they're such high level shooters that it's a problem, right? Whereas, you know, some of the offensive talent surrounding Dallas in these groups is they're not as good at beating some of these aggressive defensive coverages. So for instance, like there was a play where they doubled Luka on a switch and Maxi Kleba airballed a three over the backside of the rim. And like there are guys with Dallas where it's like, yeah, we don't want to just leave them wide open all game, but like a late contest we can live with kind of thing. Whereas you can't do that with Michael Porter Jr. You can't do that with KCP, and Aaron Gordon's under the rim where he's not missing much, right? So like that is one of those things where like I would be more willing in those situations rather than having Jamal Murray just switch. I would hedge in those situations and essentially rotate on the weak side and make sure that you're just leaving the right guy open, because both Kyrie and Luka are aware of the fact that for them, a tough contested shot is probably better than an open look for some of these other guys. And so they probably will allow you to chase over the top and to recover and get back in front and not give up the switch. Then as the shot clock winds down, they'll have no choice but to ISO Kyrie against KCP or Luka against Aaron Gordon. If you chase over the top, I think it'll inevitably end up in a Luka or Kyrie ISO just against a better matchup. I don't think Luka's going to pass out and just live with, you know, Maxi Kleba taking threes down the stretch of these games. Like they want to get the right player to take the right shot, right? And there's just more flexibility with Dallas to leave openings than there is against some of these other better teams like Boston or like Denver, for instance, right? So like, again, I thought that was something execution-wise that they could have been better at down the stretch, but we're being nitpicky. I actually had this in my power ranking segment, but I'll just say it right now. They're 11-2 since the All-Star break, and their two losses are games that they led in the final seconds by 3 points, and crazy shot-making took the games away. So make of that what you will, but to me, that's pretty scary, and it looks a lot like a Denver team that is hellbent on repeating, and that's why I feel so confident in them. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yeah, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Attention all wrestling aficionados. Wrestling with Freddie makes its triumphant return for an electrifying fourth season. This is Freddie Prinze Jr., and I am beyond thrilled to announce that our wrestling extravaganza is back, and joining me once again is the one and only Jeff Dye.
Get ready as we highlight the most jaw-dropping matches, dissect the fiercest feuds, and uncover the latest twists and turns in the world of pro wrestling.
We're dusting off our legendary side quests and unleashing a barrage of brand new segments that will keep you guys on the edge of your seat, like our talks on Unsanctioned Thursdays.
Freddie, you know we gotta give the people what they want. This season, we have an all-star lineup of special guests who are gonna be gracing our podcast, bringing with them their own unique insights, experiences, and all of that in the world of pro wrestling and beyond.
Whether you're a seasoned wrestling veteran or a fresh-faced newcomer, we promise an experience like no other. So buckle up, wrestling fans. Listen to Wrestling with Freddie as part of the My Cultura podcast network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty: Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, moving on to Suns-Bucks. This was an interesting game because what if I told you that Phoenix took 50 jump shots in this game? They got 65 points out of them, so 1.3 points per jump shot, and they got blown out. And that's because the Bucks took 56 jump shots and got 88 points out of them, which is 1.57 points per shot. So Phoenix had this incredible shooting performance on the road in Milwaukee and got killed because Milwaukee shot them out of the gym to an even greater extent. Now, I'm gonna start with the Milwaukee side, but this was one of Phoenix's worst defensive performances of the season. We'll get a little bit deeper into it in a minute. But really, the story of the game early on was Bobby Portis. And I've been defending Bobby Portis all year because there are a lot of Bucks fans that are low on him just because he's a backup center. And, you know, backup, anybody in the league who's a backup is a backup for a reason, right? Like, if Bobby Portis was everything he is offensively, but like less prone to cold spells and just way better defensively, then he's making $25 million a year and he's starting for somebody. Like, it's unrealistic for people to have those levels of expectations. And like, to me, you can't do much better than Bobby Portis as a backup center. Ask Nuggets fans if they'd take Bobby Portis as a backup center. Ask Lakers fans if they'd take Bobby Portis as a backup center. Like, that you could do a hell of a lot worse than Bobby Portis. And he was incredible at the start of this game. And for the record, he's been a good offensive player all season. Just a couple quick numbers for you guys. 230 points on 227 post-ups, including passes, so over a point per possession. 1.10 points per spot-up possession. That's 67th percentile, so he's a great shooter and closeout attacker. Picking and popping, picking and rolling. He personally shoots 61.4% in effective field goal percentage on shots, on pops and rolls. That's 1.2 points per possession. That's awesome. He personally shoots over 51% on unguarded catch-and-shoot jump shots, which is going to be a theme because Phoenix was leaving him open to start this game. It started with a coverage opening. This was when Drew Eubanks came into the game. So I've talked a lot about this concept before, but when you run drop coverage, and again, drop coverage is real basic. The big guy who's guarding the screener is going to drop back and keep the ball handler and the roll man in front of him, right? the on-ball guy's chasing over the top. So here comes the screen, guy's chasing over the top. He's trying to funnel into the screen defender that's waiting. So if the guy rolls to the rim, if the guy screens and rolls, he can effectively kind of guard both, right? Especially if he's an elite defensive player and he can kind of lunge and stunt and be in the right places. But if he pops, any sort of drop coverage has no counter for the drop or for the pop other than just to offer a late closeout. That's all he can do. So the guy comes over the top, screener pops, right? The big guy's waiting. As soon as the pass goes, he's got to close out. Or you have to close out from the weak side, which leaves another guy short, open, right? So like it is a fundamental baked-in opening of the coverage. You run pick and pop against a drop coverage, you're going to get wide open threes for your big man. It is just like how it works. That's just how the coverage works, right? So Drew Eubanks early is just getting absolutely barbecued by Bobby Portis screening and popping, right? But then he gets hot, right? And again, when the guy gets hot, you kind of have to make a certain adjustment, right? At this point, Yusuf Nurkic comes back into the game, and he's doing a better job in his coverage of kind of like lingering by Portis, but he's not offering hard contests. And I'm literally sitting here, and I'm like, this guy is engulfed in flames and is like 6 for 7 from the field, and all 6 of his makes have been jump shots, or I think 5 of his first 6 makes were jump shots. And you're offering like a like again. Did you guys remember earlier this year when the San Antonio Spurs scouting report got released, or I think it was Dallas's scouting report of the Spurs for a preseason game, and it was like all the breakdown, and they talk about like how you close out on shooters. We had very similar scouting reports when I was in college at the NAIA school, which was like the best coaching staff that I personally played for. And like they do all the research and they tell you, it's like, okay, this guy, you're closing out hard, meaning like you have to be like completely up in disrupting the shooting pocket. Like even a contest doesn't work. You have to disrupt the shooting pocket before he gets up into his release. When he gets up into the release, it's over, right? And then they have everything from there to like closing out short, which is like, I'm literally going to run out at you, but I'm purposefully going to stop short. And then if you shoot, I'll offer a late contest. And it's like Bobby Portis is 51% on unguarded catch and shoot jump shots. Field goal percentage, not weighted for threes. That's like he just makes more than half of them. And so like at this point, he's already scorching hot and you're throwing short closeouts at him. And if you guys want to see a visual example of what I'm talking about, go to my Twitter feed at @_JasonLT. I clipped like 5 or 6 examples of this. But Yusuf Nurkic was just straight up just not paying attention and just letting Bobby Portis shoot. There's another one. He comes out, Bobby Portis in a transition possession, cuts through along the baseline, and Kevin Durant points and tells Nurkic to pick him up, and Nurkic just doesn't run with him. So Portis catches on the right wing, and then all of a sudden Nurkic is like, oh shit, I left him open again, and he sprints out at him at this point, but Bobby just kind of pump fakes and takes a sidestep and knocks down another three. It was bad defense. Then Malik Beasley hits a couple threes in a row. Now we're into that like late second quarter stretch. There's a play. They're running a ball screen on the right side of the floor. Dame is. And Bradley Beal, who's guarding Malik Beasley, straight up, Malik Beasley's on the left wing. Dame's running the ball screen on the right wing. Okay. Bradley Beal straight up turns his back, like Malik Beasley's behind me, turns his back to go like offer a third defender at the ball screen. The ball screen hasn't accomplished anything. They haven't even run it yet. So no one's open. So Beal's helping for no reason. So Dame just goes, okay, just throws a swing pass to a wide open Malik Beasley. They had already made 16 threes to this point, and they're just leaving dudes wide open. Malik Beasley, by the way, went into the night as the 9th best 3-point shooter in the entire NBA, right? After that, Vogel tries a little bit of zone. They run like a 3-2 zone, which a 3-2 zone, the way it looked like they were, I think what Frank Vogel was thinking in this 3-2 zone was essentially having all 5 3-point shot spots occupied. But again, it's about execution. Kevin Durant's in the left corner guarding in the 3-2, but because it was unoccupied, he kind of started down at the block. Malik Beasley runs to the corner, and KD's just too slow getting out there. And Malik Beasley gets open again. He had just made that 3 beating Bradley Beal. Now they're down 22 points and the game's over. Like it was honestly one of Phoenix's worst defensive performances of the season. And they like, again, like we talk a lot about shooting luck, and look, I want to be clear. I do believe that there's a variance element to shooting. We'd be all foolish to pretend that like that doesn't exist. But there are so many different things that factor into it that go way deeper than just like nearest defender. And it's like you let a guy get comfortable. You let a team get comfortable with wide open looks. And then even when you do start offering token contests later that qualify as like a the defender got within, you know, whatever distance, but it doesn't matter because they're confident, they're in rhythm, and there's a difference between being there on time and being there late. Because like if you get there and you get the hand up, but you didn't actually disrupt the fluidity of the upward shooting motion, it's gonna go in when they're like that. Even further, like I've seen teams that can concede shots into teams missing, but they're like teams that drag games down into the mud. Teams that like are super physical and they kick your ass for 48 minutes to where even when you're wide open, you're exhausted and you can't knock the shots down. Phoenix is not one of those teams. They're not physically imposing like that. They're not going to be a team that can get away with packing the paint and leaving guys open. They're going to have to be better about getting out to shooters. So Phoenix goes on a run. They get it back to six on an Eric Gordon kind of like janky pump fake give and go situation where he kind of like takes a goes up like he's going to take a bad shot, nearly gets blocked, throws it down to the block, cuts down, gets a little layup. It's 100-94. So they get it down to six. There was like a minute and some change left in the third quarter when that shot went in. Milwaukee went into the fourth quarter up 15. They turned it from 6 to 15 in less than 2 minutes. And it was mostly Dame driving a lot of downhill pressure, drew a foul on Devin Booker, if I remember correctly, drew another foul. I can't remember who the second one was on, got to the foul line a couple times. And then right before the buzzer just kind of takes that same kind of drifting to the right, pull up three or drifting to the left, pull up three when he hit the game winner a few months ago. But just a quick little flurry from Damian Lillard and whatever run or hope that Phoenix had to get back in the game was gone like that. And I do think it's interesting that Dame has looked a lot more in rhythm in these games that Giannis has been out. And to me, that's a strong indicator that more of his issues this year have been about rhythm rather than about his decline. And to me, that's super encouraging. And for the record, if you go back in this recent stretch, he's like, I can't remember the exact stretch of games that I pulled this morning, but his last sample of the last few weeks, he's up around like 38% from three, and his field goal percentage is like 44%, and scoring volume hasn't been great, but he's been knocking down shots at a higher clip than he did to start the season. Chris Middleton looked great, 22 points on only 15 shots. He had 7 assists. Super important element to Milwaukee reaching whatever offensive ceiling they have is getting Chris Middleton out there and humming on offense. And then here's the thing. They did not defend super well yesterday. They gave up a 128 offensive rating to Phoenix, so technically they defended bad. There were a couple of smart things they did, though. Like they really kind of removed KD's aggression from the game. And one of the things they did that was really smart is when KD would have his cleared side ISOs, they would bring help from the baseline and then pre-rotate like windshield wiper rotation from the weak side, the skip pass. So basically, normally, like you'll see a double team from one pass away and it'll be super easy to make that kick out pass, right? But because they were doubling from the baseline side and rotating from the skip pass and taking advantage of Phoenix's issues sometimes with beating double teams with smart decision making and quick on time and on target passes, they were able to kind of effectively rotate out of those KD double teams without giving up too much, which was the one little silver lining defensively from an otherwise, you know, mixed bag of defense. On the Phoenix side, it's really that simple to me. Like if they defend like that, they're going to get beat in the first round. They're not good enough in some of these other areas to get away with just leaving people open like that. And again, like I've seen Phoenix have really good defensive performances. I know it's in there. It's just a question of consistency. I mean, I saw a quote from Kyrie after the Mavs game saying the same kind of thing, like, oh, we know we can do that. And it's like, yeah, that's great. But like I talked about yesterday, when we were talking about the Kings, if it's not a habit, then when shit hits the fan, I don't trust you to be able to do it. It's got to be a habit. It's got to be something that you... It's unusual when you don't do it, not unusual when you do it. And we're getting to that point with Phoenix and Dallas, where both of those teams, where it's like when they do it, it looks great. But when they don't, they can lose to anybody. And it's a problem. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yeah, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Attention all wrestling aficionados. Wrestling with Freddie makes its triumphant return for an electrifying fourth season. This is Freddie Prinze Jr., and I am beyond thrilled to announce that our wrestling extravaganza is back, and joining me once again is the one and only Jeff Dye.
Get ready as we highlight the most jaw-dropping matches, dissect the fiercest feuds, and uncover the latest twists and turns in the world of pro wrestling.
We're dusting off our legendary side quests and unleashing a barrage of brand new segments that will keep you guys on the edge of your seat, like our talks on Unsanctioned Thursdays.
Freddy, you know we gotta give the people what they want. This season, we have an all-star lineup of special guests who are gonna be gracing our podcast, bringing with them their own unique insights, experiences, and all of that in the world of pro wrestling and beyond.
Whether you're a seasoned wrestling veteran or a fresh-faced newcomer, we promise an experience like no other. So buckle up, wrestling fans. Listen to Wrestling with Freddie as part of the My Cultura podcast network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty: Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, Kyrie Irving as the most skilled player in the league. So obviously Kyrie makes the shot. We did a breakdown of the shot in our breakdown of the game, so I won't get into it right here. Mavs fans and Nuggets fans looking for a breakdown of Mavs Nuggets, you can find that on our YouTube feed in the full episode if you happen to be watching a breakout clip. But we have Damian Lillard come out after the game talking about whether or not Kyrie Irving is the most skilled player in the NBA. Now, this has been a debate around the game of basketball for a very long time. And specifically, I think this moniker is one that we use with Kyrie specifically because of the fact that he's kind of a confusing player. What I mean by that is, like, Kyrie is like super, super good. There's a pretty substantial gap, in my opinion, between how good Kyrie is and how much he's valued by most basketball fans. This is something I've been pushing back on for years now. It's like, okay, so you disagree with some stuff Kyrie did off the floor. Okay, so he's had some clear examples of poor teammate behavior. But when the dude is on the court, he's incredible. He's literally incredible. And like we literally just saw the other night with Luka out, Kyrie almost single-handedly pulled his team to a win. Like they are... Like we overcomplicate this a lot of the times when we talk about basketball players, and we overlook, because it's almost become an expectation for a player. We overlook what a player is actually accomplishing on the court. Kyrie is a guy who can straight up be your number one if you're great everywhere else. Can he be the number one on a limited team? No. Is he a floor raiser like that? No. But the dude can run an offense. And he competes hard enough defensively when he's locked in that he can be a positive defensive player. He was a positive defensive player on the 2016 Cavs. So I think a lot of this is like galaxy brain, right? And so the way people counteract that is when they have this half of their brain that's going like, Kyrie's overrated, Kyrie's bad teammate, Kyrie's this, Kyrie's that. They counteract that with like, oh, well, you know, he's the most skilled player in the NBA. Instead of just talking about the fact that he's just really great at basketball. And to me, that specific phrase, most skilled, it really just depends on how you're defining that. To me, if I had to define what specifically Kyrie does better than most players in the league, it's a versatility of skills. He has the best combination of footwork, ball handling, and shot making from all of the various spots on the floor out of anybody in the league, in my opinion. Like, there are guys who are better than him in ball screens, but they're not as good in the post. There are guys that are better than him in the post, but they're not as good in ball screens. There are guys who are better than him in ISO, but they aren't as good in the other areas. Kyrie is literally capable of doing every conceivable basketball thing about as well as anybody in the league. But that doesn't necessarily make him the most skilled, in my opinion. For instance, I think when people ask me who the most skilled player in NBA history was or is, it's very obvious to me. It's Steph Curry. Who's the only player beneath the height of 6'5" who is a top 10 player in NBA history? It's Steph. I have him as the fifth best perimeter player of all time. And he's pretty much definitively a top 10 player in NBA history. All the other dudes around him are big guys. Either big forwards or centers, right? Or shooting guards that are 6'6 and freaky athletic, right? So, like, Steph has proven just in what he's been able to accomplish on the court that when it comes to winning basketball games on the strength of his skill, no one's better than Steph. But to me, with Steph, it's focused in specific areas. So, for instance, Kyrie Irving, in my opinion, has a more advanced ISO bag in terms of the numbers of moves that he can go to. But Steph's just way better than him at shooting. And Steph has been able to weaponize that shooting, both on ball and off the ball, to a greater effect than Kyrie has been able to weaponize all of his footwork and dribble combinations and shot making. So I can't in my right mind say Kyrie's more skilled than Steph, because Steph's skill beats Kyrie's skill every single time. And I don't blame Steph for, like, for instance, Kyrie, here's just one simple example. Kyrie Irving is a better vertical athlete than Steph. Steph is bigger and stronger. They're equally quick, but Kyrie's a better vertical athlete. He also has a shot where he shoots at the top of his jump, where Steph shoots a little bit more at the beginning, a little bit like on the way up in his shot. So, for instance, doesn't make any sense at all for Steph to work on, you know, complicated post turnaround footwork, because he's never going to use that. He's not enough of a vertical athlete, and his jump shot release is not built to turn over his left shoulder and elevate over the top of a defender in a post up and knock down a shot. Now, that's not to say Steph has never hit a turnaround jumper. Of course he has, but it's extremely rare. It's not a shot he goes to, and he usually needs a lot of separation to do it. That's not a shot he works on, because it doesn't make sense for him to work on it. So Kyrie, because he is a better vertical athlete, and because he does shoot at the top of his release, or release at the top of his jump, he is a guy that actually can use and does use turnaround jump shots all the time. Famously, game 5 of the 2016 NBA Finals, in that fourth quarter run, I think he hit two big left shoulder fades over Klay Thompson, where he drove hard to the left, planted and turned over his left shoulder, got great lift, shot over the contest of Klay Thompson and knocked the shot down, right? Like, it's just a difference. But at the same time, like, bottom line is, Steph, for damn near his entire career, has come off of ball screens and off-ball actions and hit threes at like 45% on massive volume, and he's learned how to weaponize that into a playmaking element of his game, both on and off the ball. And Steph is able to weaponize his skill into more points. And therefore, he's a better basketball player, and therefore, he's the most skilled player in NBA history, in my opinion. But if I was looking for some sort of claim to fame for Kyrie, to me, he is the most versatile skill set in the NBA. He can score like forwards do. He can score like shooting guards do. He can score like point guards do. He can do what Steph does and come off of a wide pin down and shoot a movement three over his left or right shoulder. He can run a ball screen and make a variety of pull-up threes in pick and roll. But he's not as good at those things as Steph is. And that's why I look at Steph as the most skilled player in the NBA. But again, like, to me, that really is just in the eye of the beholder, and arguing about it doesn't really make a ton of sense, just simply because, like, most skilled to one person may not mean the same thing to another person. For instance, like, Steph, in my opinion, is a much better playmaker than Kyrie. But like, does that factor in as a skill? Steph is a much better off-ball player than Kyrie. The ability to move without the basketball and weaponize that, is that a skill? It just depends if you're factoring it in. Because if we're not factoring that in, if I'm just strictly looking at, like, one-on-one play, then I might lean more towards Kyrie, or I have to think about it, but, like, it's a different discussion, right? And that's my point. Like, it's really difficult to kind of nail down the parameters of this. But what, like, if I had to, based on my kind of interpretation of what most skilled is, It's the one guy in NBA history who's beneath the height of 6'5", who's a top 10 player in the history of the game. That's Steph. He won with the skill and did it better than any other skill player in the history of the league. Therefore, it's him. And that's why I'd give him that title. All right, moving on to our power rankings. Number 10, a new team, Dallas Mavericks. Bounced back nicely from their disastrous East Coast road trip in February. They've won 5 of their last 6. They're 8th in defense over that span. Remember, their defense really fell apart on the East Coast trip. So obviously that's encouraging. They legitimized it all with a gigantic win over the Nuggets yesterday. Kind of demonstrated some of the advantages they have in terms of their ability to capitalize on the lesser defenders in Denver's roster by being more deliberate about their matchup attacking and some of their perimeter speed. Number 9, the LA Clippers. The bottom continues to fall out for them. They've lost 4 of their last 5. They are also now just 8-10 in their last 18 games. They are 17th in offense and 26th in defense over that span. All of a sudden, this what was kind of a slump is starting to look like something that's a lot worse. This is a quarter of a season where they've been mostly a bad team, and that's a problem. Last night against the Hawks, I only checked out the second quarter of this game when the bottom kind of fell out. Bad defense all over the floor, especially in transition, just like basic shit, like not getting back and protecting the basket. Really stagnant offensively as well. It just kind of looks like bad vibes. And like, again, this is one of those things. You can build good habits, and the Clippers did for a long time, but they've now spent a long time building bad habits. And again, like, this is one of those things where like, sometimes it's really difficult to regain control of the situation, which is why it's so important when you identify you're starting to let go of the rope a little bit. That's when you have to knuckle down and kind of regain your identity. They've let this drag on for a really long time now, and they could be in some trouble. Number 8, the New Orleans Pelicans, 2-1 week. They beat the Clippers and the Blazers. They lost to the Cavs. Zion's last 13 games, 24 points, 7 rebounds, and 6 assists, 58% from the field, 33% from 3, 74% from the line. Really, the season turned around from them on the strength of their defense and Zion Williamson's offensive leap that he took. It kind of seemed like a part of the circumstance of him just kind of getting into shape over the course of the season as well. Zion's been one of the best and most versatile shot creators in the NBA this year. 1.07 points per possession in pick and roll on 415 possessions. That's 82nd percentile. 1.04 points per ISO on 373 possessions. That's 71st percentile. 1.05 points per post-up, which is in 248 possessions, which is 56th percentile. He's personally shooting 51% from the field in all of those situations. So really impressive shot creation season from Zion. But make no mistake, they're winning on the strength of their defense. Second best in defensive rating over their last 15 games, and also second best at forcing turnovers over the course of that 15-game span. Number 7, the Cleveland Cavaliers. They beat the Pelicans, but they lost to Houston and Phoenix. Still really struggling to score the basketball. With Evan Mobley out, they've put Georges Niang in at the 4, and it just hasn't gone well on both ends of the floor. He's getting attacked a lot on defense, and he's not making enough shots on the other end, probably in large part because he's having to work so hard on the defensive end with teams picking on him. Both Donovan Mitchell and Caris LeVert are slumping right now, so a little bit of a downturn going on in Cleveland. Number 6, the New York Knicks, 3-0 week. Great win against Sacramento on Saturday. Really bullied the Kings physically. OG Anunoby is back. First 3 games, the plus-minus hero keeping it going. They are plus 45 in OG Anunoby's minutes over the last 3 games. Number 5, the Minnesota Timberwolves. Kind of a light schedule week for them. They only had 2 games. Super impressive defensive performance against the Clippers. Kawhi went down, and then they just strangled the life out of Paul George and James Harden to get a win. Then they blew out the Jazz. I still don't love Kyle Anderson at the 4, but they got another month to kind of figure out what they want to do on that front. I'm sure they will. Again, I still lean towards either going with Naz Reid for bigger matchups and then going with Nikhil Alexander-Walker for smaller matchups. I just don't think Kyle Anderson at this phase is having enough impact on either end of the floor to justify it. Kind of feels like just putting a forward out there for the sake of putting a forward out there. Number 4, the Milwaukee Bucks. The West Coast trip was an absolute disaster. They went 1-3 and their defense got absolutely shredded. But they came back. They got a big bounce back win against Philly. And then their offense broke out in a huge way against Phoenix, an outstanding jump shooting game for them. Another game where Dame looked really comfortable with higher usage, which is encouraging to me. Just kind of in terms of like whether or not this has to do with his kind of rough season, whether or not it has to do with decline or just the fit. And I lean more towards the fit, which is encouraging because all you really have to do is figure it out by the time you get to Boston. And they have plenty of time until then. Chris Middleton's first game back, he looked great. Only thing that's concerning, a 124 defensive rating for Milwaukee over the last six games, which is really bad. Even in the win against Phoenix, they got lit up defensively, a 128 defensive rating in that game. So need to regain control of the situation on defense. Number three, the Oklahoma City Thunder. 2-1 week. They beat Dallas and Memphis, lost to Indiana. Jalen Williams missed the Indiana game, so their loss, obviously they were shorthanded. But he came back and was incredible in a big win over that red-hot Mavericks team. Just a really interesting example of high-level shot-making while also getting to the rim with his power. Defensive plays at the end of the game, making a big block at the rim, had a nasty dunk in kind of garbage time. Or I should say, like, kind of to ice the game on a back cut. Just love his combination of talent and competitiveness. I think he's a star in the making. Number two, the Denver Nuggets. Their loss to Dallas in Boston's undefeated week have Denver dropping to 2 in my power rankings. But here's all I'm going to say. They have 2 losses total since the All-Star break. And both of them were games where they held a 3-point lead in the final seconds and lost basically just on supreme shot making. A contested pull-up three from Kevin Durant, a 30-foot bomb from Luka Doncic, and Kyrie Irving making a crazy left-handed floater. Make of that whatever you will in terms of whether or not it's a matchup weakness. I go the other way. If you're 11-2 with 2 last-second losses and you're the defending champion and you're ramping up going into the postseason, that to me is a big box checked for, like, primed to repeat. And it's a big part of why I'm still so confident in Denver. Number one, Boston Celtics, undefeated week. Some light games in their schedule against Portland, Utah, and Washington. But they had one of their most impressive wins of the season against Phoenix. I thought Al Horford was an absolute monster in that game, torching both of pretty much every Phoenix big man who played for overhelping in the paint. Tatum and Brown were both amazing in that game as well. They're clicking on all cylinders. It seems to me pretty consistently whenever Boston has a disappointment, like those back-to-back losses to Denver and Cleveland, they tend to bounce back in a big way, and they really did. They're sitting at number one in our power rankings. All right, guys, that is all I have for today. As always, I sincerely appreciate you guys for supporting the show. We'll be back tomorrow morning with another instant reaction as well as a mailbag. I'll see you guys then.
It's Freddie Prinze Jr. and Jeff Dye back in the ring. Wrestling with Freddie makes its triumphant return for an electrifying fourth season. Hey, Jeff, are you ready to rumble our way into an all-new season of Wrestling with Freddie?
You better believe I have. I've been practicing my body slams, and I'm jacked.
All right, don't go injuring yourself now. We'll be highlighting the best stories and matches of the week in wrestling from AEW, WWE, and have one-on-one talks with the best talents in the world of pro wrestling.
Listen to Wrestling with Freddie on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.